Hey, just because you have a job doesn't mean you're an employee. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. We start with a big question that will only keep getting bigger. In this increasingly on-demand economy, what makes you an employee exactly? And when are you, say, an independent contractor? The implications are huge when it comes to worker protections and worker flexibility. New guidance from the Labor Department is trying to clarify the situation. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The Labor Department says its new guidelines are not a change in policy, but a kind of litmus test for when you're an independent contractor and when you're an employee, entitled to things like overtime, benefits, and workers' comp. David Weil is the Labor Department's wage and hour administrator in charge of the guidelines.
Our mission is to ensure a fair day's pay for a fair day's work.
To do that, the department looked at six factors, including how much control the employer has over the worker. Merrick Masters directs the labor program at Wayne State University.
If you can control what the hours people work, what they're supposed to wear, all those kinds of things come into play.
Masters thinks the new guidelines tilt the playing field more in favor of workers who filed suit, claiming they're misclassified as independent contractors and should be full-fledged employees. This is a big issue in today's on-demand economy. Here's labor attorney Shannon Liss Reardon.
The guidance that was issued today by the Department of Labor is marvelous.
Liss Reardon is on a class action case representing California Uber drivers who say they should be employees. She cites another factor mentioned in the department's guidance, whether a worker is permanent.
But someone who is working on an ongoing basis until one side or the other decides to terminate the relationship, that's an employee.
Liss Reardon says Uber's employees are permanent. But an Uber spokeswoman told me many of their workers have other jobs, aren't permanent, like the flexibility they have, and wouldn't want to be classified as employees, no matter what the Labor Department says. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen was on the Hill today, and she'll be back there again tomorrow, talking to Congress about how the economy is doing and when interest rates might go up. And today, she said pretty much what she said before, namely that the Fed plans to raise them pretty soon.
Economic conditions likely would make it appropriate at some point this year to raise the federal funds rate target.
There you go. Or maybe not.
Let me emphasize again that these are projections based on the anticipated path of the economy, not statements of intent to raise rates at any particular time.
So I guess we'll see. Markets today, we're watching Greece more than Yellen. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. Earlier today, President Obama announced a new initiative to bring high-speed internet access to more people. The project is called Connect Home. It'll provide high-speed broadband access to families in low-income housing developments. It's a partnership with private companies who will be footing most of the bill. They include Cox Communications, Sprint, and Google. The program will include, obviously, the internet access, but also training and digital literacy programs and even devices for some low-income users. The administration says getting into the internet business will help bridge the digital divide for about 275,000 households. We're joined by Julian Castro, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Secretary Castro, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I wanted to ask you, as I read through the announcement, it occurred to me, why does the government have to do this? Was there a failure of competition in broadband infrastructure in the private sector?
What we see out there are two things. First of all, how important it is today for every American to have access to the internet. It has changed the way that we live, the way that we work, and it's a requirement that folks have access to the internet to be competitive in this 21st century global economy. The second thing is that over 50% of low-income households don't have access to the internet. So Connect Home really is about bridging that digital divide and doing something to get folks connected and to close that achievement gap.
And how important is wireless in that equation? We talk about kids going home and not having broadband internet access, but it seems like wireless might be more universally accessible.
But having internet access, whether it's wired or it's wireless, for a young person growing up in a public housing community, both of those things are a plus. And as part of the Connect Home initiative, we have some internet service providers that are going wireless and some that are more traditional and hooking up communities. Either way, the big win for these young folks is that now they're going to actually have internet access and they're going to have a chance to do the homework that before they weren't able to do as well, or they had to go to a public library or somewhere else. Wall Street Journal today had this article about how many young people get out to places like McDonald's sometimes because they don't have internet access at home. So we're focused on getting folks connected.
And can you estimate now how much this might cost?
There's no cost to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Now, there's a $70 million collective commitment that our private and nonprofit sector partners have made to Connect Home. And so there's a significant investment that they're making.
And a project like this seems to be a clear statement that broadband is a utility, that it is a must in today's world. But in the words of one internet commenter, should internet access be a state-provided infrastructure item?
Folks can have their own, I think, and do have their own views in terms of whether the public sector should do that or the private sector. Connect Home is really being driven by the private and nonprofit sectors in conjunction with the public sector. You know, there's no HUD funding that's going into this. This really is a private and nonprofit sector effort that's teaming up with public housing authorities. So our focus is for public housing communities, making sure that these families are connected.
And do you think that's a good model going forward? It seems like private-public partnership has been a model that people are experimenting with. You know, can you bring the private partners on board because it allows them to advertise their service a little bit? I mean, Best Buy offering, you know, computer training, it's almost like native advertising.
Well, we're happy that that a number of internet service providers and other organizations and businesses that provide digital literacy training or other educational opportunities are part of this. There are up to 200,000 young people that are going to be able to avail themselves of the internet now who weren't before. Public-private partnerships help to make that happen. And, you know, for the last few decades, public-private partnerships have been increasing. And I fully expect that in a resource-constrained environment here in Washington, D.C., in state capitals around the United States and in city halls, that you're going to see more public-private partnerships to get things done.
Secretary Julian Castro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Back to Greece for a moment, where protesters have taken to the streets, even clashing violently with police earlier this evening. They're angry about the terms of a bailout, which the Greek parliament is set to vote on later tonight. Know who else is complicating the path forward for that agreement? The IMF, the International Monetary Fund. It said it won't be part of any deal that doesn't involve debt relief for Greece. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains how that might work and why it's so contentious.
There are a few ways Greece could get some relief from its staggering debt. Creditors could lower interest rates, they could give Greece more time to make payments, or they could just wipe some of the debt away, say, forget about a chunk of the money you owe us. But all paths are not created equal.
The line in the sand for some European states seems to be no principal reduction.
Anna Gelpern is a law professor at Georgetown. She says that hard line is all about optics.
Right, you don't want to say we forgave Greek debt and lost money for the taxpayers.
Gelpern says the IMF is warning that Greece has an unsustainable level of debt, that if forgiveness is off the table, there will have to be some big concessions elsewhere, maybe pushing the timing of payments out decades. And don't forget, Greece still needs more money. Muj Tabaraman with the Eurasia Group says giving Athens the tens of billions it needs for a new bailout becomes a really tough sell if it's also erasing old debt.
So it's very difficult to convince skeptical creditor parliaments to both lend money to Greece at the same time as assuming losses on loans already extended.
Plus, all eyes are now on Greece. So Steve Hanke at Johns Hopkins says Eurozone leaders are worried about setting a precedent.
If we allow people to continually break rules, pretty soon it's not going to be just Greece breaking the rules, but Italy will break the rules next, or some other country that's in the Eurozone.
In other words, Greece and its creditors still have a long way to go. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We called up Elena Karinatis, who helped us produce our two live shows from Athens earlier this week, and asked her what it feels like to be in Greece today. Elena, thanks so much for coming on.
Hi, thank you very much.
So a lot has happened in a few days, would you say?
Yes, too many things in a very little time here, and some people feel really betrayed. They feel betrayed by Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. Others, most of them, feel betrayed by European leaderships, especially by German leadership, due to what happened during the EU summit.
You have the IMF this week saying that Greece's debt might be too big to even agree to a bailout deal. What do people think about the IMF now?
I think that people here are starting to welcome this IMF's report because they show the truth. They show that they indicate that the debt is not viable at all. So I think that people don't think that IMF is the worst villain anymore. I think that they think that the German leadership is treating Greece in a hostile way, let's say.
What will happen if this deal falls apart?
I don't want to imagine what will happen if this deal falls apart. I don't want to imagine what will happen if Greece gets out of Eurozone and returning back to drachma or another currency that we don't know how many months that we'll have to wait till this will be organized in a way that we will not be in a catastrophic road. It will not be in chaos. I don't want to imagine this.
Are people talking about this on the street?
Yes, I think that this is all that we are talking about. All we're talking about, not only on the streets, but at work. When we come back at home from work, we talk about it with our families, with our friends. It's the one thing that we have, everybody has on their minds, because everybody is really, really anxious about what's the future, what's our future right now. We don't even know if this deal is going to be on its way, and how many more days or weeks or months we will have to wait until we see something that we know what it is.
Elena, thank you so much for joining
us.
And
I must say something else, that the truth is that this this agreement is really harsh, and it seems very unfair for most of Greek people who kept hoping for a better agreement. They're really tough austerity measures once again.
Elena, thank you so much for joining us from Athens, Greece.
Thank you, too.
We took the show to Greece earlier this week, as you heard. You can check out all of our coverage at marketplace.org. Coming up.
And it was pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, space exploration has its ups and downs. But first, let's do the numbers. Numbers were slightly down today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave back 3 points, a tiny fraction of a percent, to close at 18,050. The NASDAQ was off 5 points, a tenth percent, to finish at 5098. And the S&P 500 fell 1 point to end the day at 2107. A little corporate news. Delta said profit last quarter was better than expected, but it looks like things will be weaker for the rest of the year. Investors shrugged that off. Shares were up 0.7%. The nation's biggest railroad, CSX, said lower fuel prices helped offset a drop in the volume of coal it moves. CSX shares rose 1%. All right, so that's planes and trains. And how about automobiles? Sure, why not? The CEO of Fiat says there will be no more offers to merge with General Motors. and investors loved it. Fiat shares were up 2%. A tie-up in the drug business, Celgene will buy the smaller biotech firm Receptos and get a promising drug in development to treat multiple sclerosis. Celgene shares were up almost 7% and Receptos up 11% on that news. European exchanges, France's CAC 40 up 0.25%. Germany's DAX up 0.2%. Britain's FTSE unchanged on the day. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.35%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. Nominations for the Primetime Emmys are announced. And it was the start of the nuclear age. 70 years ago, on July 16th, the first atomic bomb was detonated in the New Mexico desert. I'm Michelle Filippi.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. The Supreme Court has weighed in on the Affordable Care Act, but there's still plenty of fighting to be done over the nation's health care law. The latest example comes courtesy of Fortune 500 companies and labor unions who've teamed up to lobby Congress to kill a tax on some of their very generous, some might say lavish, health plans. It's sometimes called the Cadillac tax, but employers and employees who may face it say it's more like a Ford Fusion tax. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more.
Most Affordable Care Act fights come from the right, not the plan to kill the Cadillac tax.
There are actually more Democrats on the legislation to repeal it than there are Republicans.
James Klein with the American Benefits Council is leading the charge, with heavy hitters like Blue Cross Blue Shield and the labor union Unite Here right behind him. Here's how it works when the tax starts in 2018. Tally up all the employer benefits, premiums, health savings accounts, you name it. If all that costs more than $10,200 for a person or $27,500 for a family, you pay. This lobbying campaign argues regular people will end up getting run over by the Cadillac tax. Brian Marshall is a school superintendent outside of San Diego.
It's really going to be a burden on our teachers, our custodians, the special ed aides and bus drivers, and that's just an attack on our middle class families.
To oppose this tax by arguing the biggest victims are ordinary middle income workers is just not right. It's just not supported by the evidence.
Howard Gleckman is with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. One estimate is that just 5 to 15% of plans would qualify for the tax. Gleckman says it's designed to root out excess, a serious problem in healthcare.
Doctors who like to do more tests and more procedures because they get paid more for it, and consumers who don't care because insurance is paying for it.
Gleckman says even with business and union forces pushing repeal, there's a big force driving the Cadillac tax. It's expected to raise $90 billion in its first 10 years. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This month marks 20 years since Amazon's online store opened for business. And maybe you heard the company is trying to use the anniversary as a way to drum up more business. Today, it's running its own version of Black Friday, which it's calling Prime Day. But the sale prompted tons of other retail giants to try to cash in on the hype. Walmart, Target, Best Buy, and others all have promoted deals this week. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has been shopping all day for work. He joins us from New York to talk about this. Hi, Mark.
Hello. And just browsing, I should say.
All right. So what does it say about the retail environment that Amazon can launch this sale, what is essentially a really big PR stunt, and have all these other retailers follow suit?
Well, it's a statement as to just how big Amazon has gotten over the years. I mean, we have to pause and tell our younger listeners that 20 years ago, you didn't buy all this stuff that you could on Amazon. It was just an online bookstore. And what Amazon has done over the years is try to get big. And so if a company is going to try and throw itself a party, you know, you can expect all kinds of other retailers to crash it.
So Amazon definitely got our attention, but now I've seen complaints all day on Twitter that people are a little disappointed. The deals aren't as good as they hoped, or they sold out right away. And meanwhile, with other online sellers having big sales today, looking to steal some customers, what can they do that Amazon can't, especially, say, Walmart?
Well, Walmart is big. We talk about Amazon being big and being able to offer free shipping because it's so huge. But, you know, Walmart looks at Amazon and they can say, well, hey, that's cool. You guys are doing, you know, nearly $90 billion in sales last year. But we came close to half a trillion. So, yes, you guys can drive a hard bargain, but we can drive a harder bargain. We can cut prices more. And the other thing about Amazon is that a lot of the stuff sold on the website is actually Amazon selling it for another company. It's around 40% of all the products that are sold on Amazon. All of that means that Amazon can't necessarily put everything, 100% of the products on the site on sale, because the third-party retailers, they can't necessarily go along with every PR stunt that Amazon wants to put on.
And then let's talk about this idea of Amazon Prime. That's, of course, the $100 a year subscription that gives people free two-day shipping and access to some media. Prime Day, we should clarify that these sales today were only for Prime members. How important is Prime to Amazon?
Well, it's very important. And what it gets down to is customer captivity. That's one of the key ways that a business can have an advantage over other businesses. So you can look at a product, and Amazon, it might even cost a dollar more than what you see on some other website. But because you can get free shipping, second-day shipping for free, you may choose Amazon over another company that's even offering a better price. So Amazon sucks you in, it makes you a member of Prime, and then it kind of becomes your first choice for shopping. And that enables it to have an advantage over other companies that don't have that same kind of captivity.
All right, we'll let you get back to your shopping. Mark Garrison reporting for Marketplace from New York. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
And now a little news about space. Actually, there's been a lot of news about space this week, of course, what with the New Horizons flyby of Pluto. It's been a good week for space exploration, but that comes after about 8 or 9 bad months. A couple of failed commercial launches recently were meant to deliver cargo to the International Space Station. Basics like rolls of toilet paper, they're hard to come by in space. Not to mention lots of sensitive research equipment, all lost. And now members of Congress are asking questions. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from Washington.
Michael Fortenberry has this $90,000 camera that was supposed to go on the International Space Station.
The camera would record meteors as they entered the atmosphere at night.
But the privately owned Orbital Cygnus rocket that was supposed to take it there blew up shortly after launch.
And it was pretty heartbreaking.
Fortenberry is the principal engineer at the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas. He and his colleagues had enough spare parts to cobble together another camera, which was loaded on the next flight to the ISS, the SpaceX Falcon 9, which also blew up. NASA lost quite a bit of gear as well. Associate Administrator William Gerstenmaier explained to a congressional hearing just how much.
The losses are borne by NASA, and we estimate the NASA cargo lost roughly at about $110 or so million dollars on the SpaceX flight.
Now don't worry, the astronauts on board the station aren't about to run out of food or supplies anytime soon. But NASA plans to keep sending cargo commercially, which worries Representative Ami Bera of California.
As we look at this partnership of commercialization and taking human beings to the space station and beyond, you know, it is a bit worrisome.
Researcher Fortenberry is trying to stay positive. He points out the first launch failed a few hundred feet up, the second a couple dozen miles up. So he's at least getting closer. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
And this final note before we go, there you are on Broadway. You train your entire life to get to the big stage. You're pouring your heart out up there, singing, dancing, sweating. And in the audience, the folks who probably paid a couple $100 to be there are texting away like they're hanging out at Starbucks. A couple memorable incidents recently. One guy jumped up on stage and tried to plug his phone in to what turned out to be a fake outlet on the set. Actress Patti LuPone grabbed a phone out of a woman's hand during her show when the woman texted through the entire thing, and Broadway has had enough. Its performers are fighting back in the only way they know how, with song.
Unless you are the president of these United States, there's nothing happening on your iPhone that can't wait. So look up.
Seriously, people, put it down. Actually, pick it back up again just for a second, or find a bigger screen and check out the close-up images from Pluto that just came in today from New Horizons, because they are amazing. And it's not that often that we visit a new planet for the very first time, even if it is just a dwarf planet. All right, that is it. That's our show for today. A perfectly acceptable day on Wall Street. The Dow gave back 3 points, a tiny fraction of a percent. The NASDAQ off 5 points, a tenth percent. And the S&P 500 down 1 point, not quite even a tenth of a percent. Robbie Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfiel, and Charlton Thorpe engineer this program for us. I am Molly Wood. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.